Okay, folks. So only one question today. Who's not picked a company yet? Okay, you know what you have to do. So. For those of you who have picked a company, you have the ingredients to estimate a risk-free rate and an equity risk premium for your company. Whether you choose to use it or not, I don't know, but you have the ingredients. So try to get it done while it's still fresh, because next week things are going to start to move a little more quickly for you, because you know what's coming a week from Monday, right? It's your first quiz. So next week you're going to have to, you know, you're going to get ready for the quiz. So this is kind of the last weekend before the weekend's taken over. So try to get caught up in the project, because nothing else, you can get that behind you. So you got a risk-free rate. Somebody remind me again, what should I use as my risk-free rate? What does it depend on? What currency I choose to do the analysis in, right? Some it's more work, some it's less work. And what should I use as my company's equity risk premium? My choices are, I can just look at the country the company is in, but that will give me a very skewed vision of risk. Or I can look at the company, where the countries the company operates in. 2 days ago, United, with, you know how companies now with markets give guidance on revenues and earnings for the next year. 2 days ago, United withdrew its guidance for revenues for this year. Why? The coronavirus, they're not sure how it's going to play out in travel. And it's a reminder again that United may be a U.S. company, and the coronavirus for the moment might be mostly in China, but in a sense, you're seeing the ripple effects play out across companies. In fact, while United was putting it out, MasterCard also withdrew its guidance for this year, because they're not sure what... It's not even that they have bad news, they just don't know. That's a reality. They just don't know how this is going to play out. But it's a reminder again of how we're all connected at the hip, that what happens in one part of the world, I mean, whether it's viral or something else, how quickly it can spread to other parts and how companies can be affected. So today we're going to talk about the third and final ingredient for the cost of equity, which is the beta. I sometimes go into investment banks and talk to their corporate finance groups about betas. And they use betas all the time. I say, where do betas come from? They look at me like I have two heads. So what do you mean, where do betas come from? They come from Bloomberg. They come from Barra. But because the reality is, if you've ever worked in finance, you never estimate a beta. You just look it up. A service provides a beta. But if you dig a little deeper, if you've ever taken a finance class or in foundations, you were told how betas are estimated, right? You run a regression of returns on the stock against returns in the market index, and the slope of the line is the beta. And then we throw the rest of the regression out saying, I've got my beta, I don't need that regression anymore. Today I'm going to stay on the regression, because there are other pieces to this regression that I think give you information about your company. First, when you run a regression, I know we've kind of forgotten this from statistics, you get a slope, that's a beta. You also get an intercept from the regression, right? We throw that away usually in finance, but that intercept, I'm going to argue, is going to tell you whether your stock was a good stock or not over the last year, over the period of the regression. Think, what does it mean it's a good stock? It did much better than expected or much worse than expected. The intercept tells you something about your stock's performance over the period of the regression. And there's also an R-squared you get whenever you run a regression, right? Again, in statistics, we tend to look at the R-squared. In finance, we throw it away. That R-squared, I'm going to argue, is going to tell you where the risk in your company is coming from, whether it's coming from the market or whether it's coming from company-specific actions. So let's think about, first, why the intercept tells you things about the stock. Let me go back to the original CAPM. The original CAPM, the return on a stock, is the risk-free rate plus beta times RM minus RF. That's a standard equation you see as the CAPM. Let's do some algebra and move items around. I promise I'm not messing with the equation. If I move items around, I can write the CAPM as risk-free rate times 1 minus beta plus beta times RM. That's a traditional CAPM rewritten. I've run a regression of returns on the stock against returns on the market. The intercept is called an alpha. So the intercept is what I found by running a regression. The CAPM tells me what that intercept should be. It says it should be risk-free rate times 1 minus beta. If I compare the actual intercept you had from your regression to that RF times 1 minus beta, I'm getting a measure of whether your stock did worse than, as well as, or better than expected. If your stock did exactly as anticipated by the CAPM during the period of the regression, here's what you should expect to see. Your intercept should be roughly equal to the risk-free rate times 1 minus beta. If your stock did much better than expected, you try this for Tesla over the last 2 years, you'll be no surprise. The intercept is going to be huge relative to the risk-free rate times 1 minus beta because your stock did much better than expected. And if the intercept is much less than that number, that tells you your stock did worse than expected. In fact, if you take the difference between the intercept and the risk-free rate times 1 minus beta, it's called Jensen's alpha. And there's a story behind this that kind of mirrors the growth of finance as a discipline. It's named after Michael Jensen, who was a PhD student at the University of Chicago in the 1960s. He became a professor there, and he picked a topic for his research. And the topic he picked, everybody thought the answer was already known. The question he asked was, do professional money managers beat the market? They're professional, they have all this data. And remember, in the late 60s, professional money managers had a significant advantage over the rest of us. They had more data, they had the models. So the assumption was, if you run mutual funds, you must do better than the average investor. So he said, well, let me check that out. There were only 125 mutual funds at that point in time. So his data was a little more limited, which is good because he had to hand collect the data. You didn't have databases. He hand collected the data. And then he computed the intercept for each of the regressions to compare to the... So basically, he computed the Jensen's alpha for each of these mutual funds. What did I say? If you do much better than expected, that Jensen's alpha should be a positive number. You're earning more than the risk-free... That's what he thought he would find is when he looked at these 125 mutual funds, that they would be doing much better in the market because they were the professionals. What he found has become one of the most enduring findings in finance. He found that collectively those 125 mutual funds earned about 1 to 1.5% less than the market. The Jensen's alpha was negative. It's the most enduring finding because you look across the last 50 years, when you look at active money managers collectively, this is a result that's been reproduced over and over and over again. I mean, active money managers have all kinds of excuses for why this is okay. Say, so we're the good ones, there are a lot of bad ones, etc. But collectively, he found that these mutual funds did not beat the market. So the Jensen's alpha becomes a measure of performance. So here's what I'm going to do with each of my stocks. I'm going to run a regression. I'm going to get the intercept. I'm going to compare to the risk-free rate times 1 minus beta during the period of the regression. And I'm going to form a conclusion about what the stock did in the past. I'm going to say, this stock was a stock that did better than expected. This did worse than expected. And perhaps we can ask, why did it do better or worse than expected? So any questions on the intercept? The intercept tells you something about performance. So let's try this out on a stock. Now, when I say your beta comes from a regression of returns in the stock against returns in a market index, there are all kinds of estimation choices I did not mention. For instance, if I take a stock like Disney, oh, incidentally, talking about Disney, did you see the news yesterday? You know how unusual it is for the CEO of a very large company to suddenly step down? There's a story here. I'm not saying I'm going to go looking for the story, but this is not the way you get a CEO stepping down. So we're going to probably find out more as we go along. But I also told you right at the start of the class, when you pick a real company, expect life to get interesting. There's a reason the Chinese curse runs, may you live in interesting times. Because interesting can cut all kinds of ways for your companies. So, you know. But if you take a company like Disney, it's been public since the 1950s. So the first choice I have to make when I decide to run a regression is how far back do I go? I could go back 2 years, 5 years. I could go back 50 years. I'll set up the trade-off. Statistically, the further back I go, the more data I have, right? So it's good. But what's the downside of going back in time? What am I trying to do? I'm trying to estimate a beta for the future, not a beta for the last 50 years. If I go back to the late 50s, Disney was a company that did not even have theme parks yet, but produced one movie every 3 or 4 years, an animated movie. It looks nothing like the company today. So the trade-off here is if you go back too far, you get a company that doesn't look like your company today. If you don't go back far enough, then you don't have enough data. Most services use between 2 and 5 years of data. And we'll talk about the variations, but 2 to 5 years. You almost never see 10, 20, 50 year betas. And for some of you, the choice is going to be taken out of your hands. If any of you are analyzing Uber, which you probably shouldn't because it's a money-losing company, but if you had picked it because you wanted to override the suggestions I made to you, you really don't have a choice of 2 years or 5 years or 50 years. You have an hour, a year, and 2 months because that's how long they've been listed. Second stop, once you've decided how far back in time to go, 2, 5, 10, 15 years, you then have to tell me how you're going to slice up the data. You're saying, what are you talking about? Let's say I have 5 years of data. I can look at 5 years of daily returns, which will give me about 1,300, because you get about 260 trading days a year, you get about 1,300 observations. I can use 5 years of weekly returns, which will give me 260 weeks, 5 years of monthly returns, which will give me 60 months. I can do 5 years of quarterly returns, which will give me 20 quarters. Again, if you pick purely based on the numbers, and I say I want more data rather than less, you're going to pick daily returns, right? 1,300 observations. Daily return betas are horrendously bad for a simple reason. Not every stock trades every minute of the day, and it really affects your daily return betas. Let's take a stock that is very lightly traded, and its last trade yesterday in the market happened at 2:20 in the afternoon. The return I'm going to get is going to be on the last traded price, right? The market keeps stays open, and over the next hour and 40 minutes, if it's down 2%, you're going to get a beta that gets thrown off, not because your stock is not moving in the market, but because it doesn't trade. So daily return betas are notoriously noisy. So the real choice you face is weekly, monthly, or quarterly. And if you go to quarterly, you really run into an issue, which is if you have 5 years of data and you break it up into quarters, you're going to get 20 observations in your regression, incredibly noisy. So if you narrow it down, you really have a choice, weekly or monthly. 2 years or 5 years, every service is going to do that dance of making one of those choices. Third step in the way. You got to compute returns. You're saying, what's the big deal? What are the two ways you make money on stocks? Assuming that you do make money, like a day like yesterday, obviously lost money. Okay? One is price change, which happens every day, every week, every month. Right? So if I have 60 months of data, every month there's going to be a price change. What's the other way you make money when you own a stock? You collect dividends. How often do you get them? Depending on the stock, some stocks pay quarterly dividends, some pay semi-annual dividends, some might even pay annual dividends. If you're computing returns, here's what you're going to see over the 12 months that you have data. You're not going to get dividends every month. You might get dividends every third month. Don't try to be fair. Know what I mean by fair? Don't try to spread it out. That's not the way the world works. If you own stocks in the month, it pays dividends. You get to collect the dividend. You don't have to give it to the guy who owned the stock in the previous month or the month before. So you're going to see dividends pop up every third month or sixth month. So the returns here are going to be computed by taking the price change and adding the dividends, if there are any in that month, and dividing by the price at the start of the month. Why at the start of the month? Because you always measure returns with what you invested at the beginning. So here's where we are. I've made a choice on the time period. I've made a choice on daily, weekly, monthly. I've computed returns. There's one final choice I have to make. The regression says I have to run a regression of returns on the stock against returns in a market index, right? That's so easy in a textbook. So I go looking for a market index. What's the problem I'm going to run into? Think of how many choices I have. Let me list a few up. When people talk about the market being down 1,800 points over the last 2 days, which index are they talking about? The Dow 30, right? So for better words, when people talk about the market, they still start with the Dow 30. What's in the Dow 30? 30 stocks. God only knows why those 30. There is, unlike the S&P 500, where it's the 500 largest market cap stocks, and you can see the rhyme or reason, Dow 30, I don't know, somebody in there in the Dow office says, I'll feel like you're taking Caterpillar out. Why I don't like bugs. Let me throw something else in. It's kind of, but the Dow 30 has a long history, and because of it, it gets talked about. So you got the Dow 30. The second most talked about index is the S&P 500. 500 largest market cap stocks. And then, of course, you have the NASDAQ and the NYSE and the MSCI. I mean, I remember sitting at in Bloomberg, you can actually list out all the indices. I think there are 8,700 indices just in the U.S. Forget about global that you could use. And you get to pick. So I'm going to ask you a question about how, because you're going to get different betas. So let's say I'm looking at Microsoft. I want to get a beta, and I want to pick an index. What exchange is Microsoft listed and traded on? It's traded on the NASDAQ, right? So let me give you the first choice. Because it's traded on the NASDAQ, should I run it against the NASDAQ? So do you see how this choice is going to paralyze you? So here's my question. How do you decide what the right index is if your objective is to estimate a CAPM beta? Notice I threw in the word CAPM in there. In the capital asset pricing model, remember we did that intuitive derivation 2 days ago? What did each and every one of us end up holding? No transactions costs, no private information. We all ended up holding a supremely diversified portfolio. Little piece of everything, right? So here's your end game. You want an index that gets as close as you can to that market portfolio. So let me throw indices at you. And you tell me whether they pass the test or fail the test. Would you ever use the Dow 30 to estimate a beta? Absolutely never, even if it's a stock in the Dow 30. Why there are only 30 stocks in it? And you know what? Every European index you look at is 30 to 40 stocks. The DAX, the CAC, the FTSE has 100. But if you look across the mainland Europe, almost every index is 30 to 40 stocks. So the Dow 30 doesn't pass. How about the NASDAQ? What's the problem with running your regressions against the NASDAQ? The NASDAQ has a lot of stocks, but it's really a tech index. Why? Because its 10 biggest companies turn out to be tech companies, right? You take them out, there's much. So even if a stock is listed on the NASDAQ, running it against the NASDAQ is not going to give me a measure of a market beta from a CAPM perspective because it's not a wide enough, broad enough index. So the NASDAQ is too tech-oriented. The Dow is too small. You could try the NYSE composite. It has 2,000 stocks. It's all NYSE stocks. At one point in time, it ruled the universe because everybody wanted to be on the New York Stock Exchange. But the NYSE is some strange weighting. They don't weight based on market cap. They weight based on stock price levels. So it's a strange index. Almost by backing into it, do you see what index most services end up using for U.S. companies? They use the S&P 500, and there is a parochial problem here, which is when we did the CAPM, did I say you stopped investing in assets once you hit the borders of the country you lived in? In the CAPM, your market portfolio could include every traded asset on the face of the earth. Do you see the other problem? Every service is still parochial about the way it estimates betas. You ask for a beta for a U.S. stock, it's run against the S&P 500. You ask for a beta for a European stock, it's run against the European index. If you ask them why, they give you a geographical answer because a stock isn't. But the answer doesn't hold up. So we're going to come back and examine how that contaminates betas. But within the U.S., people end up using the S&P. It's only 500 companies, right? And there are 7,000 listed companies in the U.S. So what's its saving grace? 500 largest market cap companies, in proportion to their market value, those 500 companies account for 80% of the market cap of the overall market because the size of the companies is so big. So it doesn't have all 7,000 companies, but it's close enough to U.S. stocks collectively that you could argue that maybe you can get away with it. So for the moment, I'm going to get away with it. And here's what I'm going to do. For Disney, I'm going to go back 5 years. Why not? I could go back 2. I could show you what the beta looks like. I'll go back 5 years. And already you can see that when people talk about betas as facts, they're lying. Why? Because when I tell you the beta for a stock, there was judgments I made. 5 years versus 2 years, I could get a different beta. So I went back 5 years. I chose to look at monthly returns. I like monthly returns because there's far less noise in terms of volatility, liquidity. So basically, I use monthly returns. So I have 60 months of prices and 59 months of returns. You see why I lose a month? To get the return, I need the change in the price. So if all I have is the first month's price, to nothing to compare it to, I don't get a return until I get to month two. 59 months of returns. I computed the return every month. So as an example, in December of 2009, now here's what happened. The stock started the month at $30.22. It ended the month at $32.25, so it was up about $2. During the month, I happened to get lucky and get a dividend of 35 cents. My collective return is the change in the price plus the dividend divided by the price at the start of the month. In that month alone, Disney delivered a 7.88% return. And I do this for every month. This isn't rocket science, right? There's nothing that I'm doing here is sophisticated. I'm just collecting prices, dividends. And you go to Yahoo Finance, you can download the prices, you can download the dividends, you can come up with returns every month. And then I did exactly the same thing for the S&P 500, but it's a little messier. Because I can go look up the level of the S&P 500 every month for 60 months. Again, I can do that in Yahoo Finance. But what am I missing if I just stop there? If I buy all 500 largest market cap stocks, what the index tells me is what's happening, the prices of those stocks, right? But what am I getting every month? I'm getting dividends from one or more of those stocks. So I actually kept track of the dividends, and you actually get dividends every month. Why? Because some stocks pay in January, some in February, so basically you get a dividend yield. It tends to peak in March and June when most companies, but you see dividends being paid. So in 2009, here's what the numbers look like. The index went from 1,095 to 1,115. The dividends on the index, in index units, the reason I say index units is indices basically convert billions into something you can handle, four numbers. In index units, it's 1.68. My total return based on that, on the index, was 1.78%. Let me pause right there. In just that month, if I stop there, Disney clearly did much better than the market. Why? God only knows. Maybe something happened at Disney, a new story. But I do this for every month. And you can see why. I can't stop with 1 month. I can form some really strange conclusions if I have 1 or 3 or 6 months. And I do this for every month. I did this with Excel. As you're saying, what else would I use? In a little while, I'm going to give you a shortcut where you can skip this entire process and have, you know, maybe your next president do it for you, but his company will do it for you. So this is my Excel spreadsheet regression for Disney. This might bring back unwelcome memories of statistics. Okay? Just bundle it and let it go, right? Because this is a regression. It's a simple regression. On the y-axis, I have returns on Disney. On the x-axis, I have returns on the S&P 500. You're saying, what's each point? Each point is a month of data. So basically, I take each point and look at the pair. It's called a scatter plot. I was told whenever you run a regression, always start with a scatter plot because it gives you a sense of what the relationship is with the data. And then I fit a line. It's called a best fit line through these points. And how do you fit this line? You could sit there with the ruler and say, that looks good, that looks, you know, you're going to drive yourself crazy. In statistics, it's a very simple process. You minimize the least squared distances from the line. Basically, you're trying to find the line that best fits. Thank God for statistics packages, Minitab and SPSS, that we don't have to do this by hand. Because that's basic. So when you run a regression in any statistics package, it's fitting the line. I'm almost there. I've got my regression line for Disney for 5 years of data. And here's what it looks like. The intercept is 0.0071. 0.71%. We'll come back and talk about what that tells you about Disney as a stock during the period. The slope of the line is 1.25. What do we say the slope is? That's your beta. What's this number in brackets that I'm giving you below? It's my warning saying, don't get too carried away. 1.25 is my beta, but by the way, I don't know that with certainty. In statistics, this is called a standard error. Basically, it says, look, I have an estimate, but given the noisiness of the data, there is a range on that number. Just be aware of it when you use the beta. And then I give you an R squared of 73%. Remind me again what that says. 73% of the variation in Disney stock happened because of things that were happening in the market. Or let me flip that around. 27% of what happened in Disney stock came from things that were specific to Disney. I don't know what Disney stock is doing today. It's a very dicey time for the market. But the fact that Bob Iger stepped down yesterday is going to play out in Disney stock price today. This is a classic firm-specific event. The market could be up 1%, but Disney could be down 5% if people liked Bob Iger. But there's actually a fairly morbid exercise that happens when CEOs step down. You know that 67% of companies, when CEOs step down, stock prices go up. In fact, perhaps the most morbid exercise of all was when Walt Disney died. Disney stock price jumped 6%. You think, that is so sick. Part of the reason was by the time he died in 67, Walt was exercising control in the company. He wouldn't let them do things that they wanted to do or needed to do because he was so caught up in running the company his way. So we don't know what happened, but this is a classic firm-specific event. In fact, talking about firm-specific and market risk, you can see how risk that starts off and you say that's not a big deal can very quickly become a market risk. When the coronavirus first came out, your reaction was in Wuhan, in China. It's, you know, it's companies that operate there. Maybe supply chains are affected. Hey, who really cares? And basically, initially, the reaction was even in the Chinese market was very restricted. But as it went from being a virus in China to a potential pandemic, you're seeing markets across the board saying, oh, my God, this could affect everyone. Because it's not just the Uniteds and the MasterCards that are affected. It's pretty much every company in one way or the other. So as you look at this graph, you're getting a sense of Disney as a company. So you ready? We're going to take this graph. And I describe this graph as the equivalent of you picking a new doctor and you come in and I run a whole panel of tests on you. Your blood pressure, your heart rate, etc. And then I use it to get a sense of how healthy you are. Because before I start diagnosing you and telling you what you should do, I need to know where you stand. So think of this as my first look at Disney. And let's see what it tells us. Let's start by looking at the intercept. The intercept for Disney, if you remember, was 0.712%. The fact that it's positive, don't reach any conclusions yet because that's a starting point. What am I going to compare the intercept to? The risk-free rate times 1 minus beta, right? The risk-free rate during the period was about 0.5% for the whole year. It's an annualized number. But remember, my intercept is based on monthly return, so to be comparable, I'm going to take the annualized risk-free rate and make it a monthly number. I can't compare a monthly number to an annual number, a monthly to a weekly. So this is the kind of a step you got to take anytime you run a regression. I'm asking what time period did I use? Weekly, you got to need a weekly risk-free rate. So in this case, my risk-free rate on a weekly basis is tiny, 0.04%. Why? Because risk-free rates were low. You multiply that risk-free rate by 1 minus the beta. If you remember, the beta we got was 1.25 from the regression. I get 0.05%. You're saying, what the heck does that even mean? If Disney had done exactly as predicted by the CAPM during these 5 years, the intercept should have been 0.01%. That's what you needed to do because essentially because the beta is higher, their intercept, minus 0.01%. That's what it should have been. Their actual intercept was 0.71%. That difference between what you see as the actual intercept and what they needed to make, that 0.72% becomes the Jensen's alpha for Disney. You think we did all this work for 0.72%? Doesn't sound like much, right? That's on a monthly basis. You make 0.72% every month, in this case for 60 months. It starts to add up. In fact, if I take the 0.72% and annualize it, the way you annualize the rate of return is you can multiply by 12 if you're in a hurry, and you can do that. But remember, returns pile up on top of each other. That works out to about 9% a year. If you believe this regression, over this five-year period, Disney did whatever it needed to do, plus an extra 9.02%. It's over and above its required return. I'll give you a very simple way to think about this. Let's assume you have a very risky stock, a stock with a beta of 2. Let's say the market is up 20%. Let's say the risk-free rate is close to 0, which is not a bad assumption today. If you have a stock with a beta of 2 and the market is up 20%, how much does your stock need to be up to break even? It's got to be up 40%. You're saying, why are you being greedy? Because if I don't build up some fat on the way up, I'm going to have nothing to burn on the way down. Because if this stock doesn't do really well when the market is doing well, I'm going to have nothing to burn off when I'm on the way down. So I need to make 40% to break even. If I tell you the Jensen's Alpha is 9.02% for the stock, you know what I'm saying, right? It's making not 20% plus 9.02, but 40% plus 9.02. It's making whatever it needs to make plus an extra 9.02%. So let's take a look at this Jensen's Alpha. Okay? Let's assume you do this for every single listed stock in the U.S. Do what? Compute the Jensen's Alpha. Starting with A, working all the way through Z. So for each one, you compute a Jensen's Alpha. What's the average Jensen's Alpha across all stocks going to be? It has to be zero, right? Because think of any other answer. If you say the collective Jensen's Alpha for all stocks is 3%, what are you saying? Markets beat themselves by 3%. I don't even know how that can happen. So there is actually some good news and bad news. The good news for Disney is it made a Jensen's Alpha of 9%. But if Disney made a Jensen's Alpha of 9%, there must be somebody on the other side who made a minus 9%. You know what the Jensen's Alpha for Tesla was over the last 2 years? It's like 88%. And what's your reaction? I wish I'd bought Tesla 2 years ago. But before you spend too much time on that regret, remember, for every Tesla, there's an anti-Tesla. I didn't want to put a name on that stock where the Jensen's Alpha is minus 88%. So before you lose too much sleep saying, I wish I'd bought Tesla, get down and say, thank you, God, for not letting me buy the anti-Tesla. Because for every stock that has a positive Jensen's Alpha, there's got to be a stock on the other side with a negative Jensen's Alpha. So you take the Jensen's Alpha. It looks like Disney did a pretty good job over this period, right? 9.02%. So I am Bob Iger. I get up in front of you in 2014 and say, look, guys, I did a good job for you. I delivered a Jensen's Alpha of 9.02%. You should give me a bonus. Sounds like a fair thing to do, right? Do you see the question I'm asking? When you see a positive Jensen's Alpha for a stock, is that a sign that the management did a good job? Or do I need to know something more? Let me make this simpler. Let's suppose I came to you with an oil company. You know what every oil company's Jensen's Alpha looks like over the last 5 years? Pretty much every large one. They all have negative Jensen's Alphas. We should fire them all, right? But before you go on a firing spree, let's ask a question. Why does every oil company have negative Jensen's Alphas for the last 5 years? Because oil prices are down. Conversely, if I looked at these same oil companies in 2012, they all had positive Jensen's Alphas. Not because they were well-run companies, but because oil prices were up. So if I'm looking at an oil company today, ExxonMobil, let's say their Jensen's Alpha is minus 7%. Before I decide to fire the management, what might I want to compute to compare that minus 7% to? The average Jensen's Alpha across all companies, because let's say it's minus 20% and you lost only minus 7%. You're a hero. I should be giving you a bonus. So when you look at the Jensen's Alpha for your company, don't jump to the next conclusion too quickly, because some of it might just be being in the right place at the right time in the right sector. Some of it might be good management, and some of it can be pure luck. I'd love to see the Virgin Galactic Jensen's Alpha in a few weeks. You read the story about Virgin Galactic? This is Richard Branson's company. He's going to take people to Mars. It went public. It went up 200% the next 2 days. I guess a lot of people are very optimistic about Mars travel. Okay? The Jensen's Alpha is going to look incredible. But again, when you look at the Jensen's Alpha, you can't jump to that conclusion too quickly. Yes? Are the companies in the same sector? So if it's an oil company, because across all companies it's zero, right? But with this, so what you're going to see is over the last decade, energy companies collectively, if you look at the S&P 500, have gone from almost 12% of the S&P 500 to 5%. Right? So without even computing the Jensen's Alphas, I know what I'm going to find collectively for energy companies. They're going to have negative Jensen's alphas. And if you run an energy company, your Jensen's alpha is also going to be negative because you were caught in the downdraft. So you're going to compare it to other oil companies, and you're going to make a conclusion based on whether your Jensen's alpha is better or worse. One final question about Jensen's alphas. In 2014, looking at this regression, it looks like Disney was a good stock, right? Delivered money. Can I make a leap of faith then, say, if it had positive Jensen's alphas in the last 5 years, that I should go buy it now because it'll have positive Jensen's alphas in the future? What's the question I'm asking? Do good stocks stay good? And do bad stocks stay bad? It'll make our life a lot simpler if that was the case, right? Because all you'd have to do to load up in your portfolio is look at the 50 biggest winners over the last 5 years, put them in your portfolio, and if you can ride past Jensen's alphas, so that story about active money managers underperforming the market must already give you the answer. It can't be that easy. I was going to say, almost no correlation between Jensen's alphas in the past and Jensen's alphas in the future. If there's any correlation, it turns out to be negative correlation. You know what that means, right? Remember that anti-Tesla I talked about with such contempt, minus 88%? If you're going to create a portfolio today, rather than have Tesla in your portfolio, you want that anti-Tesla in your portfolio. Because if history is any indication, those stocks deliver a more positive Jensen's alpha in the future. The correlation is low. Your time horizon has to be very flexible. So there are lots of ifs there. But my point is, don't take the Jensen's alpha for your stock and say, hey, that must be a great stock. Let me add that to my portfolio. Any questions on Jensen's alpha? Yes. Okay, let's take a company with a beta 1. Right? When it's a beta 1, then the risk-free rate times 1 minus beta is going to basically give you 0. So if you have a stock that has a beta 1, in a period, so think of this as what your stock should do in a period where the market does nothing. It has a 0% return. If you have a beta of zero, a beta 1, your stock should do nothing as well, right? But if your stock has a beta 1.5, and the market does nothing. Remember, a month in which the market does nothing, you're actually earning less than the risk-free rate. Remember that RM minus RF in the brackets? So if you have a high beta in a month in which the market does nothing, you should actually lose money. That's what the RF times 1 minus beta is telling you. If you're a safer stock in a month in which the market does nothing, you should make some money. So I'm comparing what I need to make. That's what you get from doing this comparison to what I actually make. Okay. Yes? Because that's what you look up. You open up the Wall Street Journal. It's not a question of using. You open up the Wall Street Journal, you could look at a T-bill rate today. It's always annualized. But I'm saying I have to take what I see and convert to monthly. So I'm saying if you go looking for a monthly risk-free rate on the Wall Street Journal or Bloomberg, you will never find it. Nobody reports monthly rates. So I'm saying you start with an annualized rate because that's how you get the information. I would love to go look up a monthly rate or a weekly rate directly, but that's not the way the world works. Everything is stated in annualized terms, so you often have to convert annualized numbers to whatever your period of reference is. It's basically monthly. It's essentially you're looking at monthly investments, right? That's what you're doing. So you almost want to go really short term, and that's why we use T-bills, not T-bonds, when we do this comparison. Right? Because we're looking at monthly holding periods and what would I have made in that period. Now let's talk about betas. As I said, most banks, most consulting firms, if you ask them where do betas come from, they come from a service. Right? So I'm going to play the role of a beta estimation service. And usually the way this works is if you're Barra, you pay hundreds of thousands of dollars as Morgan Stanley. Barra is a West Coast-based beta. You know, it's a service that's been estimating betas for 50 years. You pay me $500,000 or a million, and you have access to my betas. Today, you probably look things up online, but there was a time where you actually had to pick up the phone. You'd call me and say, I am analyzing Disney. Can you give me a beta for Disney? You ready? Let's go back in time. You're analyzing Disney. You want a beta for Disney. You pick up the phone, and you're calling me. I'm Barra. Say, hello. So I want a beta for Disney. If I were to give you a point estimate, you know what a point estimate is? A single number. From that regression, what would my point estimate for Disney be? What's the best single number I could give you? Well, if you remember, the regression is 1.25. So I'm going to say beta is 1.25. And then I'm going to try to hang up the phone really quickly. I hope that you never ask the follow-up question. But he said, wait. That's your best point estimate with 67% confidence, which is not a whole lot of confidence, because remember, I'm going to be wrong a third of the time. You asked me for my beta for Disney. What's the significance of the 67%? In statistics, it's plus or minus one standard error. If you remember, the standard error for Disney was 0.10. With 67% confidence, your true beta for Disney could be anywhere from 1.15 to 1.35. So no, that's not very much confidence. How about 95% confidence? Now we're talking about two standard errors. You're going one. Again, I want to emphasize the fact that when services report betas, they make it look like facts. But if you run a regression, you get a range on the beta. Of course, you can't report a range because it doesn't look precise. It's false precision because there's always a range. When you run regressions, you get a range on the beta. You're saying, this is a terrible stock. Look at how big the range is. You know, the standard error I got for beta, for Disney's beta was much lower than the typical U.S. company's regression beta. So this is actually a distribution, not of betas, but of standard errors on betas. The median standard error for a beta estimate in the U.S. is about 0.20. Now, in my valuation class, I actually showed the regression beta page for GoPro. Remember GoPro? Do people actually even buy GoPros anymore? There was a time, it was this high-flying stock, very risky stock. I put up the beta, and the beta was 1.6925, 4 decimal points. You know what the standard error in the beta was? 0.50. Why are you giving me 2 decimal points when you got a standard error of 0.50? You can say roughly somewhere between 0.5 and 3.5. Use whatever you want. But with risky stocks, that's exactly what you're going to see. Right? So the standard error of the beta is like a warning. It's a red flag that you should be looking at, saying, I have a regression beta, but there's a big standard error. So we've looked at the intercept, we've looked at the beta, we've got a range. Let's talk about the R-squared. Again, statistically, we know what R-squared tells us. R-squared tells us the proportional variance in your dependent variable that is explained by your independent variable. That's how my statistics professor explained it to me. What's my dependent variable here? It's the stock. My independent variable is the market. So let me rephrase it. The R-squared tells me the proportion of the variance in Disney that is explained by the market. 73%, which means the remain. He said, who really cares? Remember the second building block for every risk and return model in finance? What do we assume? That investors, the marginal investors in the company are diversified, and because they're diversified, what do? They get rid of the risk that is specific to the company. So if I asked you, in the case of Disney, what percentage of the risk in Disney can you eliminate by diversifying? What's the answer? The 27%. The remaining 73% is going to stay in there. And again, that's a high number by company standards. If you took a stock like, I don't know, NVIDIA, semiconductor maker, the R-squared could be 20%. Okay. So I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. Let's say you're a diversified investor, and I give you the R-squared for Disney, 73%. And I give you the beta for Disney at 1.25. And then I also give you the beta for Amgen, which also happens to be 1.25. But I tell you Amgen's R-squared is only 25%. So the two stocks have exactly the same beta, but you are a diversified investor. Which of these two stocks, if either, would you prefer in your portfolio? The lower R-squared or the higher R-squared? Or you won't care? How many would pick the higher R-squared stock? Why? Because there's less company-specific risk. Let me ask you a follow-up question. You're a diversified investor. After you diversify, what happens to company-specific risk? It goes away. So whether you have a 25% or a 73% R-squared, by the time you're done diversifying, it's all gone, right? So if you're a diversified investor, you don't care about R-squared. If I hold 100 stocks, I don't care if I have a 7% R-squared or a 70% R-squared. By the time I'm done diversifying, all of that firm-specific risk is gone anyway. So let me reframe the question. Let's assume you're an investor. We all have eccentric relatives. And we always are unlucky enough at Thanksgiving to have to sit next to that eccentric relative. I'm going to be your eccentric uncle. Put him in some part of the country where you never go. He's sitting next to you and he says, I don't trust these mutual fund guys. They all rip you off. I own only three stocks. You try to explain to him based on your corporate finance class about standard deviations and covariances and correlations, but he's too busy eating the turkey. He says, three stocks, that's it. If you're an investor who's not going to be diversified, you're going to concentrate your portfolio. And remember, I said most individual investors who try to pick stocks hold three to five stocks. Now let me ask you the same question. If you're a diversified investor, I said you didn't care. But if you're a concentrated investor, which of these two stocks should you hold? Remember, you're not going to eliminate the firm-specific risks. And now if you buy Amgen, what happens? You get rewarded for only 25% of the risk. That remaining 75% is going to swing your portfolio around with no expected return. So if you're going to be concentrated, make sure you're concentrated in some nice, big, diversified companies. Buy United Technologies. It's already in eight businesses. For God's sakes, don't buy NVIDIA because it's even if it's a good stock, you're risking too much if you're not a diversified investor. So if you're a diversified investor, you don't even care about R-squared. But if you're a non-diversified investor, if you're somebody who's going to concentrate your portfolio, you're going to pay less of a price with something that is already, you know, has a high R-squared. Most of the risk is getting rewarded than one, something that has a low R-squared. The problem with many investors is not only they hold only three stocks, but the three stocks are called Tesla, NVIDIA, and Uber. And then they complain about how unfair the world is to them when things go down, saying, you know, my portfolio is down 30%. It's a conspiracy. No, there's no conspiracy. You got this on yourself by loading up on three stocks, which have a huge amount of company-specific risk. So now I'll give you the easy way out. You know, 20 years ago, this was 1998, your assignment over the weekend would have been to go collect the price data from, that time Yahoo Finance was not there. You'd have to go find a database, collect the 60 months of data for your stock, 60 months in the index, put in an Excel spreadsheet, run the regression. It's not a big deal, but it's tedious. I don't know when we got our first Bloombergs, but when they came, it was a godsend. Because now when you want to look up the beta for a stock, what do? You find a Bloomberg terminal that's free. You type in the name of your company, and you type in a beta. Type just beta, and you get a page that looks like this. This is the beta page for Disney. Using exactly the same 5 years that I used, using exactly the same index that I used, and using monthly returns. It's, in fact, it should be a replica of my regression because they're using the same choices that I made. So let me go down the Bloomberg output, and if it matches what I got in my regression, great. But if it doesn't, then we have an issue, right? Because we should both running regression, we should get the same data. Let's start at the top. It says raw beta, 1.247. Remember what my regression beta was? 1.252. We round up to 1.25. I can live with that. Okay? I'll come back to the adjusted beta in a minute. Then it says intercept, 0.60%. Bloomberg is incredibly sloppy about decimals and percentages. Don't ask me why. The intercept is already in percent. So that 0.60 is 0.60%. Do you remember what my intercept was? It was 0.71%. And when the first few years when I'd run these regression betas on Bloomberg, I'd constantly run into this issue of the intercepts not matching. The betas would be close, but the intercepts would be different. And there's actually a simple reason for it. When I ran my regression, I computed returns in Disney. I took the price change every month. And what else did I bring in? The dividends, if there were any. When I did the market returns, I took the S&P and I brought in the dividends. Bloomberg regression betas are run purely with price changes. Why? Because it's so much easier. There isn't an individual in Bloomberg running these regressions. The computer runs it automatically. And dividends are a pain in the neck. So Bloomberg regression betas are run with price changes. And Bloomberg's defense is, why are you making such a big deal? The beta we're getting is pretty close, and that's all you take out of this page anyway. So who cares if the intercept is different? But the intercept will be different. And for most companies, the difference will not be very large. You know what types of companies you really have to be wary of that intercept for? A stock that pays a big dividend. If any of you are doing REITs, Real Estate Investment Trust, where the bulk of your return comes from dividends, a Bloomberg beta for a REIT is almost meaningless because you've taken the biggest part of their returns out of the calculation. The R squared is 73%, very close to mine. So my beta and R squareds are very close. My intercept is off, but it's not off by enough that I'm going to freak out. So for 99% of you, when you run the Bloomberg beta page, it might not be quite right, but it's close enough and it saves you so much trouble, you might as well use it. Which leaves you with one final number. You're saying, oh, and this is standard error of the beta 0.10, very close to mine as well. But there is this number, adjusted beta. Sounds fancy, right? Adjusted. Say, what's it adjusted for? You know what the adjusted beta is for every single company Bloomberg estimates betas for? It's a raw beta times 0.67. Hang in there with me. Plus 0.33. You're saying, what? So if your raw beta is 1.8, your adjusted beta will become 1.53. As I give you these examples, think of what's happening to your beta. 1.8 becomes 1.53. 1.5 will become 1.33. 1.2 will become 1.13. 0.6 will become 0.73. So what's the adjusted beta doing? It's taking the regression beta and moving it towards 1. What's so magical about 1? It's the average beta across all stocks. They're trying to be helpful. They're saying, guys, your company will probably get bigger over time. It'll probably get more diversified over time. It'll move towards 1, so let's move it towards 1. To which your response is, please stop helping. Because these weights must be magic weights. Bloomberg estimates adjusted betas for 40,000 companies for every single one of them. The adjusted beta is 0.67 times raw beta plus 0.33 times 1. I could ask you where the weights come from, but it wouldn't be fair. I didn't know. It's in 2004, 5, sometime around there. I decided to call Bloomberg, not the mayor, but the company. Maybe I should have called the mayor. Might have got a better answer. And they put me in touch with the beta calculation guy at Bloomberg. There's actually a guy at Bloomberg whose life it is to maintain this page. Imagine how exciting his life must be. He goes to the cocktail party and says, I'm the beta guy at Bloomberg. Dozens of people gather around for anecdotes. Not. The guy was pathetically grateful to get a call from the outside world. I don't know what they do to the guy. Maybe they keep him locked up in a basement room, feed him through a hole in the wall. He said, I'm so glad you called. I have all day to answer your questions. I'd have all day to ask him questions, but I was afraid if I hung up the phone too soon, he might do something rash. So after what I thought was a polite period of conversation, small talk, I finally hit him with a question. Why 0.67 and 0.33? 2 minutes of silence. I can hear papers being rustled, terminals being turned off and on. And finally he comes back on. He says, I don't know, it was here when I got here. I said, what? He said, I was hired 3 years ago, it was already here, don't blame me. I said, I'm not blaming you, I just want to know where the numbers come from. He said, I don't know, here when I got here. I have 12 books out there. I have the title for my 13th book already picked out. Do you know what it's going to be called? Here When I Got Here. Because if you've ever worked in any place, there are these numbers that come out of left field. So why are we using that number? I don't know. It was here when I got here. When did you get here? 1979. You've never stopped and asked? No, I don't pick up rocks and look at what's under them. I just do what I'm told. It's amazing how much of corporate finance and valuation, the answers become, here when I got here. Why do you use this risk premium? Here when I got here. That can never be the answer. I mean, I can agree or disagree with the answer, but at least give me an answer. So I told you I didn't know where the weights come from, but that's actually a lie. I knew the original source of the weights. I wanted to see if Bloomberg knew what the source of the weights was. Remember I talked about Barra? Barra was one of the first beta estimation services set up. It was set up by a guy called Bar Rosenberg, who used to be a professor of finance at UC Berkeley. So Barra in the 1970s, and he basically, you know, took, you know, papers that were published in the Journal of Finance and put them into the service, saying, hey, this is up to the minute, this is state of the art. And one of the papers that was published in the early 1970s was a paper published by a Wharton professor called Marshall Bloom. And here's what he did. He took 100 stocks. You're saying, why only 100? When you have to hand collect data, it kind of acts as a natural constraint on how many companies you have in your sample. In the early 70s, you hand collected the data. So he took 100 stocks and he tracked their betas every year for 10 years. So he started off in 1962 and he classified companies based on the beta from high beta to low beta. Then he tracked the betas of each of the classes over time. And guess what he found? Over the 10 years, betas moved towards one with what he called a shrinkage factor, which in statistics basically means a convergence factor of roughly two-thirds and one-third. Barra built it into its first estimation services in the early 70s. Every estimation service since has taken that and either used exactly that number or a number close to it, and every one of those services still continues to do it. They've just forgotten where they originally got in the first place. So now you know. But having known all of this, if you ever have to use a Bloomberg beta page, please use the raw beta, because I think you know which direction one is. And that's all the adjusted beta is telling you. So if you're at 1.8 and you want to get to 1, could you get there? You're 1.6, 1.4, 1.21. Why do I need somebody holding my hand saying, in case you're confused, let me give you a number closer to 1? That's all the adjusted beta. There's nothing adjusted about it. Just a beta move towards 1. Now, I'm going to take that regression beta page. And this is the page I've been leading up to for about 100 pages. So you've forgotten what's happened in the remaining 99. Let me remind you. What were we trying to do? Estimate a hurdle rate, right? These are all numbers that we ran into along the way. So I want a hurdle rate for Disney in US dollars in November of 2013. What's my first step? I need a risk-free rate. Since I'm doing everything in US dollars, my risk-free rate was the US 10-year T-bond rate, 2.75%. So that's my starting point. I need a beta for Disney, and if I trust the Disney regression, I'll come back and talk about why you might not want to trust it, but if you trust it, the regression beta is 1.25. And my equity risk premium for Disney is 5.76%. Do you remember how I got that? I looked at where Disney got its revenues, and I got the risk premiums for each part, and I took a weighted average. Risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium gives me an expected return of 9.95%. We do this over and over again in finance classes, and we sometimes lose touch with what exactly it even means. Risk-free rate plus beta times RM minus RF. Let's take this 9.95% apart and look at what it tells us intuitively. Okay? Let's first play the role of potential investors in Disney in 2013. So let's say this is November of 2013. I've got this 9.95% I've computed. And I'm going to use the 9.95% in a couple of sentences, and you tell me whether this is a fair way of describing what the 9.95% is. So your potential investor, it's November of 2013. 9.95% is the return you can expect to make in the long term on Disney if the stock is correctly priced and the CAPM is the right model for risk. How many qualifiers did I add in that sentence? Let's take them apart. Expect to. So if you don't get it, don't come to me. It's an expectation. Long term. This is going to come to me after 2 years. And it could be 50 years. If the stock is correctly priced. If it's mispriced, God only knows what the return will be. And I have four qualifiers in the sentence. I'm a very lazy person. I put four qualifiers in. It's because I'm trying to make the statement true. This is technically true, but it's arid. It's a very, very antiseptic way of describing expected returns. If we lived in a world where markets were efficient, everything was correctly priced, and the CAPM was the right model for risk, 9.95% is the return you can expect to make. And if you want to make a higher return, what am I going to tell you? Find a higher beta stock. If you want to make a lower return, lower beta stock, everything's driven by the beta. I don't like that description, so I'm going to give you a second description which I find more appealing. 9.95% is the return I need to make on Disney in the long term to break even on the stock. Suddenly I've become a very needy person. Why am I not just settling for 2.75%? It's a risk-free rate. If I make more than that, it's good, right? Why do I need to make more than 2.75%? Remember the danger plus opportunity? If I'm exposing myself to danger, why the hell would I settle for 2.75%? So the 9.95% is what I need to make because I've exposed myself to risk. And this gives me a framework to think about valuation or investing. Let's say you do your own research on Disney. You look at their movie portfolio, you look at Disney streaming, you spend days on the research, and based on your research, you conclude you can make 12.5% a year for the next 5 years. What do you need to make? 9.95%, but based on your research, you think you can make 12.5%. What does that make Disney to you as an investor or an analyst? Buy, sell, or it's a buy. I've never understood, you know that most equity research analysts, when you talk about the CAPM, they say, oh, I don't use the CAPM, I just pick stocks. How the heck do you do that? In fact, if you took a look at a typical equity research report, here's what you'll see. You'll see the price today and a target price. Price today is 50. The target price is 17 3 years. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do with it. I should be happy the target price is higher than today's price. But to make the judgment on whether this is a good stock or not, I need to take the target price, compute a return from it, and then compare to what I need to make on that stock to break even. Hurdle rates don't tell you what to buy. Hurdle rates tell you whether you should be buying whatever you're thinking about buying. It's what you need to make. So when you look at this number as an investor, that's what it's telling you. This is what you need to make on Disney. And for Disney to break even as an investment, it needs to make more than that number, be a good investment. If it makes less, then you look elsewhere. And if this were an efficient market, roughly speaking, it's going to make 9.95% on an expected basis. Any questions? Now let me switch roles. I'm now the CFO of Disney. You're my potential shareholders. And what have you all decided that you need to make 9.95% to break even, right? If you're my potential stockholders, you're my equity capital providers. You see what this 9.95% is to me as the CFO of Disney? If this is what you need to make, not even to be happy, just to break even, this becomes my cost of equity. When people talk about cost of equity, they act like it comes out of equations and models, but it really reflects the fact that you as investors, when you invest in my company, have a certain rate of return you need me to make just to break even. So collectively, when I go look at projects, I need to try to deliver more than this cost of equity. And if I'm looking at accounting returns, I want a return on equity that exceeds the cost of equity. I want to take projects that deliver more than this cost of equity. So that same 9.95% becomes my cost of equity. We talked about hurdle rates. We're halfway there. At least for the equity side, we now have a number, right? And what is it based on? It's based on the currency that I decide to do the analysis in. How much risk there is in your stock to a diversified investor. That's always the baggage you carry when you use betas. And what countries you operate in through the equity risk premium. That becomes the cost of equity collectively for your company. Doesn't mean every project in Disney you can get away using this cost of equity. We're going to come back and slice and dice Disney and say, if you're building Disney Shanghai, would you settle for the same cost of equity as in a Disney Avengers movie? The answer is absolutely not. But that's the second layer we can go to because this is basically what they need to make collectively as a company. Now to show you how much this rests, remember those three sessions we spent on corporate governance? You're saying, why are we wasting our time here? We should be talking about risk-free rates. Or maybe you're saying, why don't we do this for the remaining 26 sessions? It'll be like a strategy class. I can't allow that to happen, right? So I did three sessions and I moved on. But I'll tell you why I spent three sessions laying the foundation. I told you the 9.95% is the cost of equity. And I'll tell you a story is how difficult this is to get across as a cost of equity if you have the wrong corporate governance system. So at 15 years ago, I was talking to the CFO of a very large Asian company. I'm sitting across the table from him. And out of the blue, he says, what's my cost of equity? I said, I don't know, 11, 12%. First, I asked him what currency, you know, he gave the currency. I said, 11, 12%. He said, it's not. I said, if you already know it, why the hell are you asking me? So I turned it back and said, what do you think your cost of equity is? It's 2%. I said, really? You know what he was calling his cost of equity? That was his dividend yield. Basically, he said, the only thing I pay on stocks is dividends. My dividend yield is 2%. So I had to explain to him what the extra 10% I was asking for. So when you invest in stock and you come up with this expected return of 9.95%, it comes from two places, right? A portion of it is going to come from dividends. The rest is expected price appreciation. So I said, no, 2% is just your dividend yield, but if I invest in your equity, I'm expecting price appreciation. That's the extra 10%. And then he asked me a question that completely floored me. He said, so what if I don't deliver the price appreciation? You see where he's going? When you borrow money and you have an interest rate and you don't make the payment, what happens to you? You go bankrupt. When you raise equity and you tell people you'll make 12%, you make only 2%. He said, so what if I don't deliver? So I told him, if you don't deliver the price appreciation, your stockholders will be very disappointed. And then they will sell your stock and your price will drop. He said, I don't care. I don't plan to raise any fresh equity. I'm a mature company. So what if my stock price drops? So I tried hitting with the corporate governance thing, which is if your stock price drops, your stockholders get pissed off enough. That critical mass of piss-offness will kick in and you get fired. And he started laughing. He says, do you see my last name? He had a nameplate in front, huge nameplate, bigger than him. Do you see the name on the company? Do you see their match? This was a family-controlled company. And he was part of the family. He said, I'm not going to get fired. You see where I'm going? If corporate governance is weak, if companies view you as stockholders as having no power, what are they going to do? They're going to treat equity as essentially free capital. And if it's free capital, what's the next step? If you think your cost of equity is 2%, I come to you with a project which is making 3%. What do? You take equity and you take the project. This is how Japanese companies dug themselves into a ditch in the late 1980s. They thought of capital as essentially free. They took projects and made 2 or 3%. And they still try to dig themselves out of that hole because they did it. So for this to be your cost of equity, there's got to be a semblance of accountability, a semblance of fear. And if that's not there, you might talk in the abstract about this being your cost of equity. When you take projects, you treat equity as essentially free money. So what I want you to do, and I suggested this in my email, but I think you've stopped reading my emails, so I've kind of given up on that. But I said, if you get a chance, get on Bloomberg, print off the beta page for your company. And do exactly what I did for Disney. And here are some of the questions I'd like you to answer. First, take that intercept and tell me whether your stock was a good or a bad stock. Compute the Jensen's alpha for your stock. What does it tell you? It tells you whether your stock was a good or a bad stock. Okay? To make a judgment on why it's positive, if you want, I have Jensen's alphas by sector on my website for 100 different groupings. So you want to see what a typical stock, so you can compare your Jensen's alpha. So start there. Second, look at the raw beta. Ignore the adjusted beta because it tells you absolutely nothing. Take the raw beta and the standard error. Come up with a range for your beta. Third step, look at the R squared of your stock because it's going to tell you something about where the risk in your stock comes from. Okay. So if you do this with your actual company on your project, because that way you're getting the project done, you're getting ready for the quiz. It's like you're doing multiple things while you're doing this. So try to do this by this weekend. Just print the page off and take it through the process, even if you haven't done the corporate governance section, because this part will get the mechanics nailed down. Any questions about regression betas and using them? So let's now carry this to the next step. Let's assume you're an advisor and I'm the CFO or CEO of a software company, very risky software company. And I ask you to estimate my cost of equity. So you come up with a beta of 2 for me, why I'm a very risky stock, much riskier than the market, and you plug things in and you say my cost of equity is 20%. Now as a CFO, when you show me that number, I'm a little disappointed because when I have a high cost of equity, what does it do? It means fewer projects can make it. So I ask you, why is the cost of equity so high? And you tell me. You tell me because I have a high beta. So I'm going to ask you a question, and I'd like you to think about the answer because it's going to lay the foundations for what we're going to talk about next. Is there something I can do as a company to lower my beta? Because if I have a lower beta, my cost of equity goes down. That's a lazy way of doing it. Go onto Bloomberg Terminal. Pick a different index, different starting point, ending point. And people do that all the time. They don't like the beta of 2, you pick a different index, you might end up with one. But that's cheating. So I want to know real things you can do as a company to bring your beta down. Anybody? Yeah. You could always buy a safe business. In fact, you can buy the safest asset of them all with a beta of 0, which is? I don't go gold or Bitcoin. Just start with cash, right? So basically, just accumulate cash. If nothing else, it's a beta of 0. So I wouldn't say any of these made sense or were good for you. But if your objective is to lower beta, By accumulating cash, you lower beta. That's the first. You could buy a safer business, enter a safer business that'll lower your beta. Within your company, though, are there things you can do to change your business model that might affect your beta? How many of you have Adobe software in your computers? Okay. I remember there was a time when I had to buy Adobe, any Acrobat, Dreamweaver, that I bought the upgrade, and I would choose to delay buying it if I didn't feel like I had to. The school always pays for it, so I didn't have to worry about it. But if you're paying for it, it was pretty expensive, and I didn't feel like I needed it, I put it off. Today, I don't even think you can buy Adobe standalone software. Maybe students can, but I have to subscribe. And it's not just Adobe. One of the advantages you get as a software company as you go from traditional selling software to a subscription model is it makes your revenues more predictable. Why? Because people in subscription models are much less likely to cancel their subscriptions. What does that do? Ultimately, what do betas reflect? They reflect your true risk as a company. You've gone from a traditional software company to a subscription company that could lower your beta. If you have a lot of fixed costs, it pushes up your beta because it makes your earnings more volatile. Maybe you could start to try to move those fixed costs in the variable cost column. You're saying, how the heck do I do it? Maybe some of these expenses could be outsourced, where you let the third party do it. It might be more expensive in the short term, but you made a fixed into a variable cost. Do you see where I'm going next? I'm going to say, look, betas don't come from regressions. They come from choices you make as a company. At the end of the game, though, I'm going to turn this back to, should I be even trying to reduce my beta? Because it's true, reducing my beta will give me a lower cost of equity. Sometimes that can be a good thing if I can make my business more stable. Sometimes it can come from just going and buying a safer business. But ultimately, I'm not judged, rewarded, or punished based on how high my beta is. I'm rewarded or punished based on what kind of returns I deliver relative to that beta. I mean, some of the greatest companies you see around there started as risky companies. They kept rising because their cost of equity, and Google first started, might have been 20%, but they delivered 40% returns. My advice to CFOs is stop thinking about the cost of equity. That's the wrong half of the equation. I hired you as a CEO of the software company because I wanted to make great software and deliver 50% returns in equity. But everybody wants to talk about hurdle rate. They want to reduce the hurdle rate, and it's the wrong focus. Because it is what it is. It's danger and opportunity. The riskiest business are the ones with the best opportunities. So you want to earn a high return equity, you're not going to get it in regulated utilities. Regulated utilities have really low cost of equity. And I wouldn't trade my risky business for a regulated utility for a lower cost of equity, because with that lower cost of equity comes a lower return in equity. So you want a high return on equity and a really low cost of equity, but sometimes you might have to accept some compromises here, which is to earn the high return equity, you might have to enter risky businesses. And then look for ways we can at least nudge those businesses back to a slightly more safer standard. So since we're doing regression betas, let me bring in my other companies in, because I can tell the same kind of story I told for Disney for my other companies. This is the regression beta page for Tata Motors. I asked Bloomberg for a Tata Motors beta. It ran the regression against the Sensex. Why? Because Bloomberg, as I said, is very parochial. You ask for a beta for an Indian company, it runs it against the Sensex. Incidentally, you can change the index and see what the... It's actually a fun game to play. If there's nobody around you waiting for the Bloomberg, is run the beta page, change the index. Change the index for the SPX, which is the S&P 500, to NFT, which I think is the Morgan Stanley Capital Index, a global equity index, see what happens to betas. Okay? So this is the regression. Let's go through the regression. The raw beta is 1.83. The standard error of the beta is 0.16. There's a 67% range, and you can calculate the 95% range. So that's a raw beta. The R-squared is 69%. So if I trust this regression, 69% of the risk in Tata Motors comes from the market, 31% is company-specific. That number now, if you run it against a Sensex, has dropped to about 35%, the R-squared. Why is that? Tata Motors in 2009 bought Jaguar Land Rover, and Jaguar Land Rover is now the growth part of Tata Motors. It's actually the most vibrant part of Tata Motors. You're saying, so what? When they bought Jaguar Land Rover, they bought themselves this company that essentially had less exposure. In fact, very little exposure to India, a lot of exposure to global markets, the way it shows up. is with the R squared you see against the Indian market. And finally, if I look at the Jensen's alpha they had was 35.42%. That is mind-boggling, right? It was 9% for Disney, and we got all excited. Tata Motors, the Jensen's alpha, was 35.4%. And whenever you get this for your stock, either a very big positive or a negative Jensen's alpha, at least stop and think about what happened during this period that allowed them to do it. In the case of Tata Motors, the answer is very simple. It was the acquisition of Jaguar Land Rover that essentially tipped the scales for them. Because within the Indian automobile market, Tata Motors has been struggling. It's been struggling because the Indian automobile market is crowded. It's got all kinds of cheap cars. Maruti ends up getting almost 53% of all the cheap cars. What succeeded for them is the Jaguar. But remember I said acquisitions are usually a loser's game? You're saying, what was different here? First, they bought Jaguar Land Rover at the right time from the right person. They bought Jaguar Land Rover in 2009. Everybody was in panic. You know who they bought it from? Ford. Ford was desperate. They just wanted to get rid of Jaguar Land Rover at any price. Horrific mission statement to give, right? Go sell it at any price. And they effectively did. They sold it for a song. And Tata Motors bought it for a song. That's the 35.4%, because when the recovery came, that very little investment in Jaguar Land Rover paid off. What I'm trying to say is you get numbers in corporate finance. Like the Jensen's alpha. There's a story behind the number. And that's what, so when you do your project, if all you're doing is reporting Jensen's alpha, I can do that myself. But I want you to look at your company and form that story. And here, that's what's driving it. Finally, I want to use this to come up with an expected return for Tata Motors. And at least initially, I want to do it in Indian rupees. The risk-free rate in Indian rupees is 6.57%. I know you don't remember. The way I got this is I started with the Indian government bond rate of 8.82% and subtracted out the default spread for India. So that there it comes in. The regression rate is 1.83. 7.19 was the equity risk premium for Tata Motors based on where they do business. And remember the big chunk of revenues they get from China. And with Vale, just to show you how this game playing can get you into trouble, I ran two betas. One was a beta where I looked for Vale, which is a Brazilian listed company where Bloomberg ran it against a Bovespa. But Vale also has what are called ADRs. ADRs are listings of the company in the US. They're traded in the US exchanges in dollar terms. And when you ask for a beta for the Vale ADR, because the listing is in the US, guess what Bloomberg does? It runs a regression against the S&P 500. And you get betas that could be 0.89 or 1.37, depending on which regression you look at. You think, which one should I use? These are all crappy estimates. I'm going to start digging a grave in the next session to bury regression betas, and I'm laying the foundation for it, because we've been almost conditioned to believe that a service runs a regression, you get a beta, you put it in, you're all set to go. This beta cannot just be noisy, but it can be incredibly game played to get whatever number you want. And finally, just to see how betas move as you change indices, I took Deutsche, ran a regression against the DAX, because that's what it gave. But as I said, I can change the index, so I changed it to a FTSE European index. Because, let's face it, the marginal investor in Deutsche is not a German investor who owns only German stocks. It's a German investor maybe holding a European portfolio. And the same thing for Baidu. It's a NASDAQ-listed stock, but you can run it against a NASDAQ, but you're getting absolute nonsense because it's a tech company run against a tech. And of course, it's going to move. If I take Microsoft and run against a NASDAQ, I'm going to get a great-looking R-squared. Why? Because it's a big chunk of the NASDAQ. Running regressions of a company against its own index might give you better looking regressions, but the betas mean less and less. So I'm going to stop there. Next session, here's what we're going to start with. I'm going to basically start listing betas and telling stories about why some companies. So basically, we're going to dig deeper to see what are the fundamentals that drive betas and use that as a foundation for a better way of estimating betas.
I just thought you would find it kind of funny. I was a commodity options trader before this, and we called up the same Bloomberg guy to try and figure out where the hell are you getting the suggested number. Figured out that they were using the same thing for equities that they were using on that, and then there was a pay to trade that, I mean, a couple firms in Chicago are putting on, where it's like, there's absolutely no reason to be adjusting this, especially in commodities where it's like, there's no.
I mean, people forget that Mike Bloomberg was a trader. So we're now using it for corporate finance. So when they do a cost to capital basis, they do. I don't know, guys. Your heart's not even strong. Why are you even trying, right? Because it's not what you do. It's going to be trading volume, liquidity, and short. It's going to be some incredible data as a trader. But when they try to give you analytical numbers, they're very sloppy. It's because they don't care. Their heart's not in. This is not what they want to talk about. They want to talk about it. These traders want to focus on. But there's a lot of stuff in Bloomberg I look at. So where do you guys get that number? I have two students who now run their estimations. They call me all the time. What should we do? And I say,
we'll figure it out. Yeah.
People figure out what they need to do. When you try to put in these analytical numbers, it's just going to get into trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they want to become a full platform that can compete with FactSet and S&P Capital IQ, and that's it.
I mean, they would come in once a month to try and ask us questions about what we wanted, and we just kept explaining things, and they'd send us something that was completely off base.
Yep,
there you go.
Yeah. So what, Chicago, you traded?
On the options side. So okay. the volatility of
so those basically
betas
the CBOT was, that you had your stuff on, and was it in the commodities exchange?
We were commodities exchange. Yeah. Market. I mean, well, whatever. We were trading everything, so everywhere. But yeah.
I had a question about the adjusted beta. Like, when would you ever use it? Or would you never use it?
I never use a regression beta.
Okay. So you don't even use the normal beta?
Look at the range. Look at how much game playing there is. I mean, that's an extraordinarily dangerous number. Yeah. Whether it's raw or adjusted, it's crappy, right?
Okay.
Because I can make that 1.39 for Vale look like it's 0.88, depending on which index I use.
Yeah.
Technically, they're both regressions.
Yeah.
They're both betas.
Yeah.
Technically, there's no reason one is better than the other. They're just different estimates. So if you have a raw beta that's screwed up, no matter how much finagling you do with it, the number is still going to be screwed up.
Why was it provided in the first place then?
Every service since Barnes, right? So it's almost like, Joe, when I got here, it's actually the right answer. So every service started since the 1970s, modeling their initial beta calculation on Barnes.
Okay.
Borrow is actually one of the better services now because they've brought in other factors. They look at things. They look at fundamentals. One of the things we're going to talk about in the session is if I gave you a company and I didn't give you a regression beta and you knew everything about the company, can you at least give me a rough sense of whether you think this company will have a high beta and average or a low beta based on what you can see it doing?
Yeah.